Thank you so much, Ron. And Frank, once again, my thanks. I'm happy to be with you again here at St. Mark's Church. I wanted to thank all of you for coming out. And I want to say to you that we are part of a movement, yes, but it is not only a movement of the present. I'd like to cite here the statement of Rosa Luxemburg, who said that in the age of imperialism, when the ruling class is compelled to wage war upon whole masses of people, threatening the very existence of organized society, in their desperate efforts to preserve a failing order, it is a struggle, she said, between socialism and barbarism. And I suggest that some 80 years since Rosa said those words, it is the same struggle. Brothers and sisters, we have to reclaim the socialist ideal. We have to illuminate the nature of the structure of power which oppresses us. It is not only in the specific and documented and orchestrated events such as those of 9/11, which is but, after all, a little continuation of the series of predations that have been visited upon the mass of our people for over 150 years, at least. Every major adventure of the U.S. rulers has proceeded on the basis of such false flag operations and such pretexts. It is not this alone. Today, President Bush gave a series of talks, actually. He was giving one today, but it's a series of five, in which he and his cohorts are once again returning to the theme of the great problem and menace of the category of terror. The world confronted by the danger of a terrorist apparatus. Ad nauseam and continuously, they evoke this theme. Now, interestingly, he combines it today when he discusses the category of terror with the idea that this is but the little beginning, this struggle of his. He says it's only the early phase of a continuing and ongoing permanent war, a war that will at least last 40 to 50 years, a war that entails some 50 to 60 countries, as the World War IV advocates had laid out, those such as James Woolsey, those who are known as the neocons, those who are centered in what is called the Jewish Institute for the National Security Affairs, as Jason Vest described it in The Nation magazine, those who are part of the Likud wing of that sector of capital, who are committed to a series of predations, a series of wars, designed to fragment each country in its turn ad seriatim in the Arab East and in Central Asia itself. But Bush has combined this as well with a reification of the necessity for a series of concentration camps, yes, detention camps, detention centers. What are those renditions of which he now speaks openly? A series of undisclosed, as to their exact whereabouts, detention centers where people are kidnapped at random in as much as 70 countries, no matter where they be. People are being picked off the streets, people who lead popular movements, trade unionists, peasant leaders, students, intellectuals, people who are associated with an opposition to U.S. policy in their respective countries, people who proclaim themselves unwilling to accept imperial control of their resources, people who mobilize their own population to resist U.S. imperialism and U.S. control, disappearing, rendered to countries and to places unknown, subject to torture which has been well described and well acknowledged. And indeed, some of those who are so kidnapped off the streets are now going to be sent again to what? To Guantanamo, Bush tells us. And where? In Guantanamo, they are held incommunicado and subject to the forms of interrogation which we know so well for what they are. Total isolation, sensory deprivation, drugs and torture, not just physical, but mental and psychological, openly acknowledged and openly avowed. This is a system in terminal decay, so manifestly unable to meet the elementary requirements of human beings that it is unfolding itself, removing the mask. We have a very clear, identifiable, and established structure of power in our society. The New York Times has disclosed and documented that 1% of our people own more than 95% of the rest of us combined. That is a very small number of people. It's a concentration of power in the hands of an oligarchy. But that oligarchy has a specific relationship to economic and political institutions in our country. They command the heights of the banking and corporate sector in the U.S. This is the elementary understanding of how power is organized that allows us not merely to identify what 9/11 represents, but to see in whose interest it is inflicted upon us, and in so doing to begin to understand what it will require to remove these people from power. Because let's be clear about this, 1% of that population with a control over the commanding heights of the economy, with a capture of the state power, is not going to relinquish that power, either willingly or easily. Nor is that power merely taking an expression of foreign control and foreign adventure and foreign dominion. There is an all-out class war upon people in our society. The eight-hour day is a thing of the past. Forget about health care, forget about pensions. The largest form of employment in our society is now part-time work. 1 out of 4 now are acknowledged to live in poverty. There's a higher infant mortality rate in Harlem than in Bangladesh. This is a war waged against the mass of our working population. And that's why the category of terror has been contrived. I often cite the former president of Avis and American Express, Robert Townsend, who wrote the book called Up the Organization, when he calculated that approximately 5,000 people control what he calls the commanding heights of the U.S. economy. And as you'll recall, he says that they regard the country as their private whorehouse, and they consider each president their personal cowboy. Today in the United States Senate, by unanimous vote, $68 billion was approved for expanding the war in Iraq and in Afghanistan. At the time that the Israeli Air Force, having been given both the wherewithal and the coordinates and the green light from Washington, was decimating the infrastructure of Lebanon. Bill 1703 was immediately passed in the House and its counterpart in the Senate, not merely calling for full support to the Israeli onslaught, but for expanding that to Syria and Iran. In the House of Representatives, the entire Democratic Party leadership endorsed that and indeed went further. Interestingly, Zbigniew Brzezinski disclosed that that resolution was not merely lobbied for by AIPAC, the Zionist lobby in the United States, but they wrote the resolution. Dennis Kucinich abstained. Barbara Lee of California abstained. Don't applaud for that. They didn't vote against it. Huh? Talk about the limits of liberalism. Cynthia McKinney abstained. You see, virtually the entire Black caucus voted for it. These are the limits of liberalism, brothers and sisters. And that is why, without an understanding of how power is structured in our society, and without being able to identify the constituency we require in order to remove it, we will not prevail. We have had many, many, many movements, brothers and sisters. The mass movement around the war in Vietnam, mass labor struggles. Some 2 years ago, I was communications coordinator for the Million Worker March movement. We mobilized around the Lincoln Memorial. We had the support of the Teamsters National Black Caucus. We had the support of the largest union in the United States, the National Education Association. We had the support of the postal workers, of AFSCME, of the railroad workers. A rank and file movement, mobilizing in our own name, it was called. People at the point of production. People who are targeted by this regime, by this cabal. We need to take the truth about 9/11, the reality of a criminal ruling class, the treason at the top to the mass of our people at the point of production. Now, one of these days, when the union bureaucrats sign a sweetheart contract over the heads of the rank and file, giving up their secure contract for permanent work, ditching their retirement guarantees, abandoning their pensions and their health care, when the courts are telling them that if they dare to strike or come out, they'll be subject to $1 million of fines a day, the ranks are going to say, no, enough is enough. The ranks will come out. And one of these days soon, when the transport workers, whether of New York or anywhere else, are faced with those assaults and they step out, the coal miners and the steel workers, the electrical workers, and the transport workers, yes, the hotel workers will say, our contract comes up in 7 and 9 and 12 and 15 weeks. They do in the transport workers, and we're next. And they'll come on that picket line. What are they going to do? Call out the National Guard? The National Guard is composed of working class kids who earn extra money on weekends. What are they going to do? Point their bayonets at their high school classmates and their cousins and their nephews and their fathers and their grandfathers and their uncles? That, brothers and sisters, is the critical question. We have a huge mass of our people who are targeted by this ruling class. That is what 9/11 fundamentally expresses. We'll come back to this. You may remember that when this war on Lebanon was launched, and I'm going to deal with the relationship of the U.S.-Israeli master plan to the Middle East and the events of 9/11. But when this most recent assault on Lebanon was unleashed, the press of the world told us that it was a response on the part of the Israelis to the, quote, kidnapping of two soldiers, as if the capturing of soldiers represents kidnapping when it's done by those who are attacked and oppressed and is somehow illicit. Here is Joshua Frank, kidnapped in Israel or captured in Lebanon. Official justification for Israel's invasion on thin ice. The original story, as most media tells it, goes something like this. Hezbollah attacked an Israeli border patrol station, killing 6 and taking 2 soldiers hostage. Here's what Agence France-Presse reported. The Lebanese police established that 2 Israeli soldiers were captured in Lebanon in the area of Ait al-Shaib when an Israeli commando unit attacked in the middle of the morning. Here's the French news site VoltaireNet.org. In a deliberate way, Israel sent a special forces and commando unit into the Lebanese backcountry at Ait al-Shaib. An Israeli tank was attacked. 4 soldiers were killed and 2 were taken prisoners. Here's the Associated Press. The militant group Hezbollah captured 2 Israeli soldiers during clashes Wednesday in southern Lebanon, prompting a swift reaction from Israel. And the Hindustan Times, with the precise same account. The Lebanese Shia Hezbollah movement captured 2 Israeli soldiers in southern Lebanon after the village of Ait al-Shaib had been attacked and resistance fighters destroyed a tank, capturing 2 soldiers and killing 4 others. MSNBC, the same. Captured Israeli soldiers at Ait al-Shaib in Lebanon. And the National Council of Arab Americans based in Lebanon, the Israelis so far have not succeeded in taking Ait al-Shaib. And it goes on to reiterate the same story. Now, false flag. Matthew Coleman. Of all Israel's wars since 1948, This was the one for which Israel was most prepared, said Gerald Steinberg, professor of political science at Bar-Ilan University. Preparations began in May 2000, immediately after the Israeli withdrawal. By 2004, the military campaign had been planned down to the last detail, blocked out, and 1 year ago, senior Israeli army officers gave PowerPoint presentations to the United States military leaders and to other officials, setting out the precise plan for the current operation in revealing detail. So the operation in Lebanon is but part of a long-standing plan. And when Bush refers to Hezbollah, which did not exist, by the way, in 1982, I was in Lebanon with Maya in 1982, and we stayed to 82 and 83 over a period of 2 years off and on. And that operation, which was called Operation Peace in the Galilee, by the way, was initiated with the green light from Alexander Haig. Under a plan advanced by Sharon and Begin to, quote, reduce the Palestinian population in Lebanon from 500,000 to 50,000 people. And there was a pretext as well. An attempt was made on the life of the Israeli ambassador in London and ascribed to Abu Nidal, since disclosed as a Mossad operation. So you see the MO. And that's an MO which is not just a key feature of 9/11, although it certainly defines it. And Seymour Hersh in the New Yorker, watching Lebanon test case, documents that this was planned with the United States and the Israelis over a period of time. Now, as I've indicated, the designs were not merely on Lebanon, but part of a plan for an ongoing attack on Syria and Iran. In the late 1970s, a young man named Benjamin Netanyahu, age 27, as described by the Jerusalem Post and by Ha'ir, the Israeli publication, had four U.S. Social Security numbers in the name of Benjamin Netanyahu, Benjamin Netai, John J. Sullivan, and John J. Sullivan, Jr. In the course of his efforts at that time, he proceeded to organize a major conference in Tel Aviv in coordination with George Shultz and George Herbert Walker Bush and leading figures in the Joint Chiefs and in the National Security Council on the category of terror and on the necessity to launch a series of preemptive wars to decompose the nations of the Middle East, and they spoke as well of Central Asia. And again in 1984 in Washington, a similar international conference on the category of terror. Again, with that objective in mind. On the first anniversary of the events of 9/11, the New York Times ran an article called The Sunshine Warrior, in which General Eric Shinseki of the United States Army gave a virtual encomium to Paul Wolfowitz for his prescience in preparing, in the late 1970s, the entire scenario for what was going to be unfolding with respect both to Lebanon and Syria, and in particular, Iraq. But every U.S. administration from 1964 on had prepared for the direct seizure of Arab oil. Indeed, the administration of Jimmy Carter advanced a direct plan for the mobilizing of quick strike force, 100,000 quick strike force, precisely for that purpose. These are the plans for the seizure of oil resources and for control that are not particular to the Bushmen or to any specific administration. Now, I want to say that with regard to the events of 9/11, it's worthwhile to recall that in 1993, there was again an attack, or I should say initially an attack, on the World Trade Center. And within minutes of its occurring, it was imputed to terrorists who were associated with Osama bin Laden, and in particular to the blind Egyptian cleric Sheikh Abdulrahman. And what we learned was that, in fact, a high-level FBI operative named Imad Ali Salem, who worked with Egyptian intelligence and also in particular with the FBI office in New York, was sent into the mosque of the blind Egyptian Sheikh, both in Brooklyn and in New Jersey, where he called on young men to come to meetings on a need-to-know basis. And in each of these meetings where the predations of the United States and of Israel and Egypt were laid out, he began to outline possible operations and things to undertake. And to each of these meetings, he wore wire. And he made transcripts of every one of those meetings. And they were deposited in the offices of the FBI office in New York, 50 file boxes, for 6 months prior to the events of 1993. At the time of the actual detonation of those bombs in the World Trade Center, Imad Ali Salem gave a statement that Ralph Blumenthal wrote up in the New York Times, in which he said that the FBI office had assured him that the bombs that were provided would not detonate. Well, that was reported in the Los Angeles Times, in the Village Voice, in the Muslim Monitor. But I think it's important to point out that it was not just the FBI that was involved. Although one of the key figures, by the way, who was involved with the Federal Bureau of Investigation office at that time, Michael Chertoff, was representing one of the main contributors to an Islamic charity that was associated with Osama bin Laden at the time. Now, one of the interesting aspects of the 1993 is that the person whose name and telephone and apartment were identified where the, quote, explosives and other incriminating evidence was found was Guzi Hadass. Now, the International Herald Tribune quoted FBI spokesman John Velliquette to the effect that Guzi Hadass was in the service of the Israeli Mossad. The London periodical Impact, March 12, 1993, and April 8, 1993, in an article called Who Bombed the World Trade Center? That on February 26, an Israeli intelligence group sent an urgent communique over a telephone access computer network about the event. And indeed, the intelligence communication service Matara of the Mossad had detailed information about the event which they had disclosed before it unfolded. 3 days after the bombing, an Israeli operative of the Shin Bet boasted of his Israeli intelligence arrangements with respect to this. Quote, Israel had advanced knowledge of the bombing, and she confirmed the communique disclosed on Matara. Indeed, a Jerusalem journalist told Irfan Mirza, the author of the Impact articles, that he had confirmed, quote, Israeli intelligence is involved in these bombings and we'll not get them to disclose this anytime soon. Zafar Bangas, editor of Crescent International, the Canadian-based journal is conversant in Islamic politics, one of the most widely read papers in the Muslim world, confirmed that Guzi Hadass not just was a long-standing Mossad operative, but was working in New York with Imad Ali Salem, the colonel in Israeli intelligence. The Mossad is a key player in the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993. But not in 1993 alone. Indeed, with respect to the events of 9/11, the hands of the Mossad, like that of the Central Intelligence Agency, are all over those events. Many of you may recall that there was a four-part series on Fox News, Carl Cameron, establishing the role of Israeli intelligence. Indeed, the Fox News broadcast described what was called the Israeli spy ring, and something like 200 Israeli operatives who were passing themselves as art students and were in fact present in Hollywood, Florida, monitoring and in coordination with the activities of one Mohammed Atta. The Israeli spy ring scandal, the story that will not go away. Evidence linking the Israelis to 9/11. Four-part series on, of all things, Fox News. Carl Cameron. But not particular to the Fox News outlet. All roads lead to Amdocs. Cameron takes us through an explanation of how and why virtually all telephone calls in the United States are billed by a single company, Amdocs Limited, which is headquartered in Israel. When you make a call, the record of the call and the billing is done through Amdocs. With a virtual monopoly in the United States, Cameron reports that it is impossible to make a call on normal phones without generating an Amdocs record of it. The super secret National Security Agency headquartered in Northern Maryland issued what is called a top secret sensitive compartmentalized information report regarding all calls being first processed through Amdocs and through the Mossad itself. Then there is the third part of the Fox series called The Converse Connection. Yet another high-tech Israeli communications company, Converse, operates a branch of the Israeli government virtually and has near monopolistic status in the United States. When you place a call, it goes through a complicated network of routers and switchers, and the wire tapping works in this fashion. Customized computers are linked to that network by specialized software. The system intercepts, records, and stores the wiretapped calls. There is a back door that is open to Israeli intelligence, and Converse maintains a link to the tapping computers, and this has been sustained. Indeed, it was authorized by the 1994 Communications Assistance in Law Enforcement, CALEA. But that's not the end of it, according to Fox News. Attorney General John Ashcroft and FBI Director Robert Mueller both were notified that the entire electronics communications of the U.S. intelligence establishment is processed through Converse and through Amdocs. Now there is Jackson Stevens. Jackson Stevens is the multi-billionaire who is part of the National Security Agency, who has a major office of the National Security Agency in Venice, Florida. Jackson Stevens is a primary funder, by the way, of both the Clintons and of the Bushes, father and son. Jackson Stevens is associated as well with the Hufmanav Aviation Flight School, where the putative hijackers Mohammed Atta, El-Shehi, and Al-Ghamdi were supposedly taking instruction in how to pilot Cessnas and Piper Cubs. But the feature of his ownership conglomerate includes something called Systematics. Systematics is the spying on U.S. domestic banking transactions directed by the National Security Agency, and indeed Systematics is owned by billionaire Jackson Stevens, of Stevens Incorporated. Stevens Incorporated, moreover, has control of what is called the Promise hardware, which along with Systematics coordinates all information of an intelligence nature and works with the Israeli Mossad. All 9/11 airports serviced by one Israeli-owned company. Yes? ICTS? Now, the role of the Israelis in regard to 9/11 is very clearly an expression of the fact that the category of terror and the demonization of any who resist U.S. imperial designs, and in particular the targeting of any in the Middle East who are attempting to resist Israeli predation, are to be attacked preemptively under the cover of the category of terror. You know, the Israeli art students, the 200 Israeli Mossad operatives who were outside of Chicago targeting the Sears Tower on the day of September 11th, Odigo Company, that had advanced knowledge and in fact warned its employees not to show up at the World Trade Center on the September 11th. Odigo, and then the story, it was covered in intensively by most media, of the so-called dancing Israelis, the five dancing Israelis who had set up on their van, part of Odigo, filming the collapse of the World Trade Center set up prior to its occurrence, who turned out to be Mossad operatives, 9/11 and the Mossad. The Mossad warnings about the hijackings reached its officials at Odigo, an instant messaging service with offices in New York, where the headquarters, and in Herzliya, where the headquarters of the Mossad is situated. The Mossad is an integral component of the events of 9/11. Mossad agents on Atta's tail, Matthias Gebauer in Der Spiegel, October 1, 2002. New revelations put the CIA in a tight spot. Israeli intelligence service Mossad was working with their American counterpart with respect to Mohammed Atta. Indeed, Die Zeit established that not only was Mohammed Atta monitored by the Mossad and the Central Intelligence Agency, but he was being run by German intelligence out of Hamburg. Now, it's interesting that with respect to the monitoring of Mohammed Atta was being financed by something called the Duesberg Foundation. The Duesberg Foundation is a virtual who's who of the American ruling class. On its board is Rockefeller and Henry Kissinger. They were financing his transport, his movements, his operations in Germany. And when he was brought to the United States, Mohammed Atta and his associates were receiving particular training. But where? At Brooks Air Force Base, at Maxwell Air Force Base, with an address at the Pensacola Naval Center in Pensacola, Florida. So the hands of intelligence, U.S. intelligence and Israeli intelligence, are all over the events of 9/11, as they were over the events of the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993. Well, brothers and sisters, it's not just Mohammed Atta. Do you recall how we were told that Osama bin Laden was responsible for the bombing of the U.S. Embassy in Nairobi and in Dar es Salaam? But the San Francisco Chronicle has disclosed and established that the people, the key people who organized the bombing of the U.S. embassies in both Nairobi and Dar es Salaam were in fact not just operatives of the Central Intelligence Agency and of special forces, but were deployed for that purpose in the training of bodyguards for Osama bin Laden. A long and detailed article about this in the San Francisco Chronicle. Again, Der Zeit, the truth about the Middle East, a documentation about how in Hollywood, Florida, right near the apartments of Mohammed Atta and al-Shehhi, French intelligence has reported that they were constantly in contact with the Israelis. The chief Israeli agent was stationed at the post office where Mohammed Atta al-Shehhi had a mailbox. Indeed, Khalid al-Midar, with whom the CIA was also familiar, the German newspaper reports, was run particularly by the Mossad. Stationed at Maxwell Air Force Base, at Brooks Air Force Base, one of them at the Monterey Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. What are we dealing with here? Mossad, Federal Bureau of Investigation, Central Intelligence Agency. This is not just an inside job. This is a central modality of ruling class policy. This is the predicate for being able to unfold the long-standing plans for the fragmentation of each country in its turn in the Arab East and the direct seizure of Central Asian oil. Now, these operations have been ascribed continuously to that sector of the ruling class that has been centered around the so-called neocons, those most closely associated with the Likud, those most closely integrated with the operations of Benjamin Netanyahu, those associated around the American Enterprise Institute, those responsible for the Project for the New American Century. Yes, those involved with the project for launching a series of preemptive wars. William Arkin has described, however, how all sectors of the military and the intelligence services under the direction now of Rumsfeld, but for plans that had long been prepared, unfolded something called P2OG, which calls for the staging of terrorist attacks in various parts of the world. And the rationale for it is in order to smoke out a response from the terrorists in order to be able to strike. Now, this is a smoking gun, P2OG. This is the active demonstration of what the nature and origin of these particular operations has been. Now, as you know, the figure who has been most demonized and to which all these events are ascribed is this person who had received $6 billion from the Central Intelligence Agency along with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, Osama bin Laden. And a series of videotapes continue to be produced putatively from Osama bin Laden, one only the day before yesterday. The first one was described as a declaration by Osama bin Laden of congratulations to the participants in the events of 9/11, the downing of the World Trade Center. Except that Hani el-Sabai, an electronics expert, disclosed and established that in fact, after all, the sound was unintelligible, but we were helped by a translation from the Central Intelligence Agency, that this was in fact a scissors and paste job. They got some footage of Osama bin Laden at a wedding ceremony a year and a half before when he's congratulating the relatives of the bride and groom. And they married it to this particular operation, and it, all over the Arab East, it's understood this was a scissors and paste job. The next attempt at this was a video of Osama bin Laden in Kandahar, where he was supposedly receiving a paraplegic sheikh from Saudi Arabia, who was coming to discuss with him, yes, the operations of 9/11. And as the CIA disclosed with regard to this particular video, the meetings unfolded during the full moon of Ramadan. Of course, there was no full moon at the time of Ramadan at that time. And the paraplegic sheikh was in Saudi Arabia at the time, and Kandahar was under saturation bombing, and there was no access in or out of Kandahar at the particular time that this is supposed to have occurred. But Osama bin Laden is on record 5 times, as a matter of fact. And in fact, with a detailed interview that he gave to Umat, the Pakistani publication, right after the events of 9/11, which was verified and reproduced by the BBC. And in that talk, or rather in that interview, Osama bin Laden stated, as I have said repeatedly, I have had no involvement in the events of 9/11, nor does my religion consider it a feasible or admissible policy to attack civilians, be they men, women, or children. Nor, he said, do I have any incentive or motive to attack civilians in the United States, because, he said, our quarrel is not with the people of the United States. It's with that band of rulers, that secret government, he says, that continually attacks Muslims and the Palestinian people, that destroys us in large numbers, that seizes our resources, that seeks to occupy our nations, that sets in motion rulers who kill on their behalf. He said, what motivates those who did 9/11 in the Umat interview? He said, there are $40 billion assigned to the U.S. intelligence agencies alone, and the vast sums of money that their military requires. How will they justify that? If you want to understand, he says in this interview in Umat, the dynamics and the responsibility for the events of 9/11, look to that secret group who controls the military and the intelligence apparatus within the United States, says Osama bin Laden. Now, you don't have to romanticize this figure to understand that this is a detailed and cogent and elaborated critique by a figure who has absolutely no political incentive whatsoever if putatively his movement and his followers are mobilized around this operation. Osama bin Laden is not only a fictive creation in terms of responsibility for these events, but as the actual person would have it, he has no connection to it. And after all, as the German press has so well put forward, and as Andreas von Bülow had formerly been with the German intelligence and with the Department of Justice in Germany, who was in touch and in possession of documents about their running Mohammed Atta out of Hamburg. This is a sophisticated operation requiring vast ability to coordinate the U.S. military, the stand down, the false rehearsals and simulations that characterize the day and the events of 9/11. How is this within the capacity of a handful of people halfway across the world operating out of besieged caves? He says it's an absurdity. The same estimate was made by the head of the ISI, the previous head, General Gul Hamid, who in an elaborate interview with Arno de Borsgrave of the Washington Times and formerly the editor of Newsweek, stated, look, you people trained me. This is a classic military operation. It involves a stand down. He says, what, interdicted space over Washington, D.C. and over New York City? And not, I mean, you were trained 24 hours a day to be in the air over such things. No warning, no nothing? No IFF, no friend to foe communication? He said, no, he said, this is an operation of the United States Air Force and its coordinates with the Mossad. How many years did I work for you people, he says. Gul Hamid. Borsgrave is so shocked. He says, well, what about Osama bin Laden? He says, Osama bin Laden? First of all, he swore to me on the Quran that he had no connection whatsoever to these events. I didn't need him to do that, says Gul Hamid. He says, we ran this guy. We funded this man. We know him and his people. Yeah, in Afghanistan, when we were putting the Taliban into power. But this operation? No, he said, it's to put people into an instant mindset where even intelligent people are bulldozed into us and stampeded into an acquiescence. He says, you know, it's interesting. He says, remember, the assassination of your president, John F. Kennedy? This is like the Warren Report, says Gul Hamid. This whole story is a cover story of the people who perpetrated this event. He says, you know what this is about, Gul Hamid, to Arno de Borsgrave. They need, after the collapse of the Soviet Union, an ideological cover for trillions of dollars to be allocated to the military for adventures abroad long planned. How are you going to sell that to the American people? Gul Hamid. Gul Hamid. So, he was succeeded, by the way, by General Mahmoud as the head of the ISI. Well, the week of September 11th, 2001, where was General Mahmoud? He was in Washington, D.C. at the National Security Council meeting with Condoleezza Rice, meeting with members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, meeting with Porter Goss, who was then just a congressman in Florida, would become the head of the Central Intelligence Agency, meeting with the Democratic Senator Robert Graham. What did he do while he was doing that? He wired $100,000 into the bank account of Mohammed Atta. When the Hindustan Times got hold of the documents, when this was published around the world, what did the U.S. authorities do? They quietly retired General Mahmoud. I mean, the hands of intelligence around these events, the central modality of control, the role of the Mossad, the role of the Central Intelligence Agency, the role of the Federal Bureau of Investigation. You know, Dan Rather, on the 10th of September, brothers and sisters, made a news announcement. He said, in the past year, $2.3 trillion of the Pentagon's funds are missing. They're lost. Well, later, Impact on the News disclosed that it was not just $2.3 trillion, it was $1.9 trillion the year before. So Robert Lieberman, who is the general accounting officer, when before the House of Representatives, had to document or confirm that no, it's $7.2 trillion without a paper trail. Well, how do you lose that kind of money? No, brothers and sisters, this is what funds the Bank of Commerce and Credit International. This is what operates the DEA's drug traffic around the world. This is what sustains the special operations that are concealed and hidden for the 11 intelligence agencies. This is the apparatus of coercive control by that criminal cabal that has command of the capitalist state. And putting it into perspective, $1 trillion, as I like to say, is $1,000 a minute since the birth of Jesus. They are cannibalizing the infrastructure of this society. They are allocating all of its resources to the coercive arm, to the seizure of resources, to the advent of new wars of aggression and deprivation and depredation on victim peoples around the world, to sustain a system that's in terminal decay. For all its massive power, what does it convey to us when it does these things? What does it say to us, by example, when the Pentagon operates within the United States over a space of 40 years, a series of release of literally trillions of bacilli in the subway systems of New York, in the school systems of Minneapolis and of St. Louis, and in the Bay Area where I live, where there was a tenfold increase in brain and spinal meningitis as a consequence. The book that describes this by Lester Cole, called Clouds of Secrecy, has an introduction by the late Senator Cranston of California. 219 civilian sites across the United States over a space of 40 years, brothers and sisters. Our population is targeted. All of these viruses that they predict will produce the next pandemic are manipulated genomes in military laboratories across the United States, as Plum Island 257 so well documents right here in Long Island. It's not just anthrax. It's not just the 1914 influenza that killed 50 million people. They've taken that virus and they've manipulated its genome. And what is the operation done for? It isn't just that the Carlyle Group, which is the repository of the Bush family's association with this $14 billion defense operation, is associated with the pharmaceutical industry as well. It is not just about profiteering, although it is true that Tamiflu, which is one of the things that they want to impose on us as a vaccine in response to the flu influenza that they're busy preparing, is run by a company called Gilead. And as I've mentioned, the principal stockholder of Gilead is Donald Rumsfeld. And Mr. Rumsfeld decided, because he didn't want to be accused of insider trading, that he wouldn't sell his stock, he'd hold on to it. And he made a 720% profit in a matter of a few months. That's almost as good as putting in puts and calls on the downfall of airlines, as they did at the time of 9/11 and as they did just recently at the time of the announced airline plot on the part of the Pakistani youth, British Pakistani youth, for which there is not, of course, a scintilla of evidence. Before we talk further about 9/11, let me mention one particular operation which I think will help illuminate it. When we look at the events of 1993, when we examine the hand of intelligence with respect to the events of 9/11, 2001, and by the way, as I went through, and as many of you are well aware, every intelligence agency in the world had advanced knowledge of the precise plans for the World Trade Center attacks and the attack on the Pentagon in 2001. Putin and Russian intelligence, Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, documented how German intelligence had knowledge of this. French intelligence, the Mossad, according to the Daily Telegraph, was meeting in Washington to discuss not only their 200 operatives in Hollywood, Florida, but the unfolding of the event. They talked about planes being crashed into buildings. Putin disclosed and Pravda documented that they laid out the number of hijackers who were going to be accused of these events. The whole thing was everybody. The San Francisco Chronicle, when it documented how Willie Brown had been instructed not to fly on the eve of 9/11, and he said that he had his national security people telling him this, and before reporters off the record confirmed that it was Condoleezza Rice, wasn't just Willie Brown. George Shultz, the very George Shultz who was the coordinator with Netanyahu of those conferences on terror and planning for preemptive strikes based upon the imputation of terrorism to those who oppose policy. Just a little parenthetical aside. Maya and I in 1982, were living in the Palestinian camp of Ain el Helwe, which means sweet spring. It was the largest Palestinian camp in Lebanon. After the series of massacres that drove the Palestinian population out, because let me just, as I've gone over many times with respect to the hidden history of Zionism, in 1947, 6 months indeed before the actual formation of the state, the Israeli state, a series of massacres were carried out from one end of Palestine to the other. From Jalil, Hebron, to El Jalil, to the Galilee. People were massacred. And as they fled, they were strafed, shot down, and slaughtered, as indeed unfolded in Lebanon before our eyes. The inhabitants of the Galilee who fled gathered around a refugee camp improvised on the outskirts of Sidon. They were for 13 years not allowed to put up any permanent structures. Then they were allowed to put up cinder block, but they were never allowed employment and they were never given any social services. It was the largest Palestinian camp. The Israelis took it as a grid in 1982 in quadrants. They saturation bombed it day and night for 10 days and 10 nights. And then they bombarded it from the air and from the sea for 10 days and 10 nights. And then they moved into bulldozers. We were there. They bulldozed over the shelters with people alive in them, with family members clinging to the bulldozers. There were mass graves in Ain el Helwe. The body fluids from the mass graves created rivulets that flowed across the camp right into the offices of the International Committee of the Red Cross that published and said not a mumbling word. They just moved their offices. And the same in Rashadiya and in Al-Bas and in Burj al-Jamali. Well, we won't begin now to talk about Sabra and Shatila, but we were in Sabra and Shatila right after, 30 minutes after the last wave of slaughter. And we, Maya filmed the Israeli officers and the Israeli tanks. And then when we were in Palestine organizing on the first anniversary of Sabra and Shatila, a mass march on Jerusalem, and we were detained and held and deported, what do you think they said? We are agents of a terrorist organization, brothers and sisters, the category of terror. Well, you remember I was talking at the beginning about a company called Converse, about the Israeli and Mossad control over communications, particularly those involving the intelligence services in the United States, about the coordinates of Odigo, about the planning and the coordination of the bombing of the World Trade Center in 1993, of their hand in running the putative operatives such as Mohammed Atta, the same Mohammed Atta who called his father on September 12th, according to Newsweek. The same Mohammed Atta who his father disclosed was murdered by the Mossad shortly thereafter. Huh? Well, Converse, it was bought out by another company in Israel called Verint. Now, that I only discovered recently, and I find it of particular interest. The London bombings. Do you know that at the time that the bombs were going off in London, there were a number of interesting things that were happening? First of all, the bombs were supposed to initially go off at the Liverpool subway or underground station, above which stood a hotel where a conference was scheduled on that day with Benjamin Netanyahu and Rudolph Giuliani, thank you very much. But Mr. Giuliani and Mr. Netanyahu, they were the beneficiaries of a warning. First from MI6, saying that had been advised by the Israeli Mossad that a bombing operation would occur and they shouldn't go to that hotel on that day. An Associated Press, Netanyahu changes his plans due to a warning. British police told the Israeli embassy in London minutes before they had received warnings of a terror attack, and Benjamin Netanyahu should not go to the hotel over the subway stop where one of the blasts occurred. Scotland Yard called the security officer at the Israeli embassy about their warnings of possible attacks. Well, the Israelis and their foreign office said, no, MI6 warned us. No, the MI6 had knowledge of it in advance, and they told us. Yeah. British intelligence and police, Associated Press, advance warnings of the terrorist attack. So the White House intelligence report surfaces, which says, guess what? They both had advanced knowledge of the attacks. Here is the Aretz Shiva, Israel National News. Israel warned ahead of first blast. Scotland Yard had intelligence warnings of the attacks before they occurred. Well, that's okay. Mr. Giuliani was well prepared. He had security experts on the scene. But something rather instructive emerged when a rear admiral gave an interview to BBC Four. He was one of the directors of a company called Visor Consultants. Visor Consultants, of this rear admiral, and it turns out of former directors of Scotland Yard, was running a simulation of the bombing of the London Underground. They were running it on the same day that the bombs were set off. They were running it, according to the interview of Mr. Powers with the BBC, at the same locations where the bombs went off and at the same time that they were detonated. 1,500 people associated with Visor Associates. The BBC correspondent said, excuse me, at the same time, the same day, the same locations? So we ran a little actuarial table on the odds. Well, what are the odds that it would occur, such a simulation in place on the same day, about 100,000 trillion to one? Well, how about on the same day, in the same place, at the same moment that the bombs are going off, brothers and sisters? 13 units of a trillion. You can't, you'd have to write it out on a horizontal chart. Visor Associates has a security company in conjunction with Rudolph Giuliani in Canada. The fellow who was in charge of the London Underground was a member and director of that company who had done the same thing for Mr. Giuliani in the city of New York. Fancy that. Visor has disclosed, and this is what we only recently learned, that in fact Visor is owned and controlled by Verint. And Verint had been in charge of all security in the London Underground, which determined movements of people, police presence, all operations pertaining to the London Underground. Verint is Converse, Amdocs, Systematics. This is an apparatus, brothers and sisters, that is indeed responsible not just for the events of 9/11, but for all of the series ad seriatim of false flag operations that are designed to terrorize people here and there. The operations in Madrid are the same basic character and modality. The people who were accused of doing these things had been monitored 24 hours a day for years by the intelligence services because Zugan had been charged at the time of 9/11 of being an associate of someone named Mohammed Atta, acquitted of all charges at the same time. But that man couldn't break wind without the intelligence services monitoring it. And as we've documented and as many have established at the time in the bombings of Madrid, the floors of the cars were driven through the ceiling. The bombs were located underneath. Same thing in London. Cambridge News, two witnesses, a picture of same. These are intelligence operations. In 2001, when I did the seven-part series on World Trade Center Uncensored History, all of us, you look at this thing. You look at these airplanes that cannot perform these maneuvers. Do you remember Colonel Legrand, Don Legrand Dupre, an Air Force pilot who had many friends out of the military who had been operating airlines in the United States, who held a series of conferences in Lisbon, Portugal, to examine the actual flight dynamics of those airplanes. And they established that these planes cannot make those maneuvers by pilot. And nobody who is trained in a little Cessna Piper Cub school has any capacity to operate them, but more to the point, every one of those planes have been subject to a long-established technology of computer control from the ground. Those are only maneuvers that can be accomplished that way. Even at the time when they first occurred, the film evidence, the television reports that were on in Oklahoma and in many places, they were not civilian airplanes. They were drones. Not one of the putative hijackers is registered on the manifests for these airplanes. Any elementary critique, by the way, one of those who has been so important in establishing what it would take to pulverize reinforced concrete into microscopic particles of powder, what it would require to reduce steel girders to molten liquid. One of those people who has established through his own scientific investigation about the physics of the collapse of the World Trade Center towers. I'm speaking about Stephen Jones, who has replicated the type of explosive or chemical that would be required, thermite and thermate, to have those effects on steel. You know what happened to Stephen today? He was removed from his position at Brigham Young University, put on paid leave, and no longer allowed to teach at that university. For what? Well, take heart. Take heart. What do you think the whole student body of Brigham Young and every university is going to conclude from this? This man who is a quiet, conservative, politically moderate figure whose expertise in fusion physics is beyond dispute, who has established through patient laboratory work and through taking actual samples from ground zero of what is the chemical residue and what is the nature of the effect on those particular elements and what it would require to replicate them, and has established through experiment the role of thermate and thermite, completely demolishing the official fiction, who's done this in a rigorous fashion, who's done this in peer-reviewed journals, who's lectured conservatively but carefully and with immaculate documentation as to his conclusions regarding the physics of these events, he's removed from his teaching position at Brigham Young University. It puts me in mind of Bertrand Russell, who, when he opposed World War I, was fired from his position at Cambridge University, banned from the coasts lest he signaled the German submarines, and sentenced to prison for 6 months. Now, at that time, I should tell you, not one of his then colleagues at Cambridge uttered a mumbling word. It hurt Bertie. But Stephen Jones has just established the fact that the authorities are running very scared of the evidence concerning 9/11, brothers and sisters. They just lit a thermite bomb under every university campus in this country because academic freedom and the right to teach and the right to speak truth to power and the right to search evidence and the right to communicate it is under siege now in the academe in the United States. So, brothers and sisters, I say that this is a system in terminal decay whose rulers and controllers are on the run, who can no longer obtain the numbed acquiescence of our people, who, as Frank pointed out, are confronted by the fact that now at least 60 million people in the United States are polled to the effect that they believe the United States government had to have some hand in the events of 9/11. That's an extraordinary product of 5 years of effort, brothers and sisters. But now I want to say this, and I'll conclude with this. Please, let's understand what our task is clearly. We talk sometimes about left gatekeepers. I prefer to talk about the limits of liberalism. But there is another kind of gatekeeping I would suggest to you, and that is gatekeeping for the structure of power in the capitalist system. Because it is not about one administration or another. It is not about Bush or his handlers. It's not Mortimer Snerd. No, it is a structure of power that has visited these kinds of events in every generation upon our people and upon those who they target abroad. Let me mention something about that. Do you remember in the appropriate year, 1984, when the liberal Walter Mondale was running for president against the far-right figure Ronald Reagan, and when we were all being whipsawed to choose the evil lesser? Huh? Well, at that time, I wrote something called Mondale Ferrara and Their Fine Feathered Friends. I just want to mention a couple of things here. The people who accompanied Walter Mondale to the National Security Council for his briefings were James Schlesinger and Max Kampelman. James Schlesinger was the consultant to the investment house of Shearson Lehman American Express, and his views on the deficit and on economics were identical to those of Ronald Reagan, whose campaign he had directed in 1976. From the point of view of the ruling class, the James Schlesinger story was composed of the right stuff. He was director of strategic studies at the Rand Corporation, where he was a senior staff member advising John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson from 1963 through 1969, including the arranging of saturation bombing in Indochina. He helped direct the Bureau of the Budget under Richard Nixon in 1969. He was Richard Nixon's co-director of the Office of Management and Budget in 1971. Mr. Schlesinger served Richard Nixon as chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission from 1971 to 1973. When Nixon resigned, why, Schlesinger carried on. He became Gerald Ford's director of the Central Intelligence Agency in 1973, and his Secretary of Defense from 1973 to 1975. James Schlesinger, however, is a flexible man. He helped run Ronald Reagan's challenge to Gerald Ford's nomination. And when Ford lost to Jimmy Carter, why, James Schlesinger became the personal assistant to President Carter. Carter appointed him Secretary of the Department of Energy, where he served from 1977 to 79. And while Secretary of Defense under Richard Nixon, Schlesinger was known as being more, quote, hawkish than his boss. He advocated first strike capability. He was the senior staff person at the Center for Strategic and International Studies at Georgetown, where he devised scenarios for preemptive strike, including nuclear preemptive strike, for Pentagon associates. And while he gave his financial advice to Shearson Lehman, American Express. Well, the Max Kampelman saga is even more stirring. Max Kampelman's relationship to Walter Mondale long predated that of James Schlesinger. He counseled the young Walter Mondale when Mondale was the protege of the youthful Hubert Humphrey. Kampelman was on the council for Hubert Humphrey from 1949 to 1955. Brothers and sisters, this is a long period of continuity. He was Lyndon Johnson's advisor to the U.S. mission to the United Nations, and he was involved in the planning of the air bombardment of Indochina. He was a director of the right-wing Atlantic Council of the U.S. from 1965 to 70, and he was a founder of the Neoconservative Committee on the Present Danger. Huh? That's the nest of the neocons. The committee grew into the Coalition for a Democratic Majority, of which Max Kampelman was vice chairman. He reestablished the Committee on the Present Danger, and his members, co-members, were a who's who of the neoconservatives who had campaigned for Ronald Reagan: Midge Dector, Norman Podhoretz, Leon Kaiserling, Gene Kirkpatrick, Richard Pipes. These are all the figures who show up at the Netanyahu and Schultz conferences on terror in Tel Aviv and in Washington, D.C. Well, Kampelman and Kirkpatrick co-authored The Strategy of Deception on 1963 about the world communist conspiracy and the need to smash it by preemptive action, by a forward policy of attacking the sources of communist subversion. Huh? Schlesinger and Kampelman were brought by Mondale to guide him in his briefings by the National Security Council. There's more on that, but I'm just going to make one more little observation. Not quite a dream team, wrote Laura Flanders about John Kerry's foreign policy advisors. Well, Richard Morningstar, who was an advisor to President Clinton on Caspian Energy, planned for the Baku, Tbilisi, and Ceyhan oil pipeline. He worked with UNICAL, and he worked with John Maresca. He worked with all the planners for the seizure of Central Asian oil. They calculated $4 trillion in short-term profit. A consortium of oil companies are deeply invested, including Britain's BP and UNICAL and Amerada Hess. Yeah. Well, then there's another of his foreign policy advisors, Rand Beers. Well, Rand Beers ran the operations in Colombia for Reagan and for Bush Sr. and then for Clinton with respect to targeting the peasant areas where they said drugs were being produced. Yeah, that's the location in which the FLN has its mass base of support in Colombia, brothers and sisters. But then Rand Beers, shocked by the advent of Osama bin Laden, became the coordinator for George Bush of the terror alerts. He was determining the color of the terror alerts, you see. And so he is going to be the national security advisor to Mr. Kerry. Well, then there's the former Minister of Defense, William Perry. He's involved with Condoleezza Rice, with UNICAL, with Chevron, in planning the control and the seizure of Central Asian oil. Is that why John Kerry attacks Bush from the right and why his brother went to Israel during the campaign to criticize Bush for not sufficient support for Ariel Sharon? Is that why he called for a preemptive missile strike on Tehran? Is that why the Barack Obama, the putative liberal young black senator-to-be from Illinois, called immediately for a preemptive missile strike on Tehran, brothers and sisters? The one big property party with two names. You can't influence these people, as I like to say. You can't change them. You can't contain them. We must build a movement that will overthrow them. A movement of the many, a movement of our own constituents, a movement of our own people in their mass. They are not just disaffected with respect to 9/11. New York Times has told us that something like 12% of the public support either one of the two capitalist parties. Well, how is that, one might ask? Well, in a national election, we get about a 51 to 52% turnout of the registered electorate. That's roughly 55, 56% of the eligible electorate. So you can cut it in half. 26% between the two parties, that's 12 or 13%. In the kind of election that we're going to have this year, the turnout is more like 19%. Huh? Sometimes as high as 23 and 24%. Of the registered electorate, not the eligible electorate. That's not because people are dumb, and it's not because they're indifferent. It's because the mass of our people have too much common sense. They look out there and they say they're all crooks, they all lie to us, they soft soap us during election time, and they sell us out the day after. There ain't nothing out there for us. We have a sleeping giant in this society, brothers and sisters, a profoundly alienated and disaffected people hungering for some way forward, some glimmer of the possibility of change that will affect their lives in a deep and abiding fashion. That's our task. That's our opportunity. That's what this movement is positioned to achieve. Let's go forward and do it. Attack this systemic blight that has poisoned our national life and build a movement to seize power in the name of the many, once and for all. Thanks so much. Yeah.